Blog Talk Radio.
July 22nd, 2010. I'm your host, Doug Kelly. I'm here with my good friend, Grant Rubin. Don't stay, Grant.
Hey, Doug. How you doing this evening?
Pretty good. We also have with us our call screener, John Rossi. Hey, John.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Hey. Good.
John will be screening your many calls tonight. I'm just planning a positive suggestion there. You know, manipulating people's minds. Does that make sense? Do you believe that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I would. It's gospel truth.
The $6 million man made it. He's in there in the chat room as we speak.
Yes, the $6 million man. Maybe he can...
Bionic man.
And, of course, they're talking about Mike, and who's recovering from a little bit of under the knife today, so he's doing well, and we're glad to hear that. Tonight, we were scheduled to have Travis Walton with us. We were looking forward to it. We're unable to get a hold of him, so don't know what the mix-up was or what happened, but we've tried continuously for the last several minutes trying to get a hold of him at the designated time, so something must have come up. So we're going to have to move on without Travis tonight. Perhaps in the future we can reschedule him. However, we do have a couple of ideas that we're going to throw around tonight.
I can do my best impression of Sylvia Brown if you
all
like.
Right, we've got psychic readings from Sylvia Brown tonight.
Okay, somebody hand me my Manhattan and a Pall Mall.
Don't get me going, Grant.
All right. So besides, where's Montel?
Oh, he couldn't make it either.
That's
all
right.
So,
hey, I just want to know a question about Mike, though. You know, rumor has it he was in there for cosmetic surgery today. And I'm just wondering, was it like, you know, a butt cheek implant or a nose job or what exactly? What's the deal, Mike? Come on.
Tummy tuck.
We won't tell
anyone.
Tummy
tuck.
Tummy tuck.
I'm not touching that one. I are not crazy.
Well, it's a shame that Travis couldn't be with us tonight. Maybe we'll be able to, you know, get in touch with him and get him back on the show because all of us were looking forward to it and we're sure the audience was as well. Probably one of the hallmark abduction cases in terms of how much of a splash it's made in the media, over the past 30 years. It's been a reoccurring thing. So hopefully we can get him back maybe in a couple weeks or so.
So, well, we're actually booked up through into October anyway, not maybe through it, but I think maybe through it now. But we'll try. Sharon's going to shoot him an email. We'll see if we can get him to call in on the call-in line. But we would be interested in having your calls tonight. We're going to talk a little bit about the history of abductions, kind of keep it on theme there a little bit. And we're also going to get into some best practices, throw around some different things that way in terms of researching. And we'll take your calls, your topics in the chat room. So if you've got something you've been on your mind or you want to toss out there for consideration, please do so. If you want to call up and say hi and bring up a topic, that would be cool too. So just for those of you who are joining us, we have not been able to connect with our guest tonight. So unless we can contact him and get him to call in, we don't know. So let's move on with our show. Let's talk about abductions. Now, Abductions have, the phenomenon has been around for quite a long time, but it really came into the public awareness perhaps in the mid-60s with the Betty and Barney Hill story. Am I correct, Grant?
Yeah, although, I was thinking about it before we went on the air when we kind of came up with an alternative strategy here. And, you know, one of the things that I recall reading a long time ago was, I'm sure our audience is familiar with the term changeling, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And if some folks aren't familiar with the story, it's an old European term that that the Europeans believed, the medieval folks believed that sometimes the fairies came in and they would steal a human child and put another fairy child or something else in its place. And one of the things that kind of that's something kind of set me to wonder. Maybe abductions have been going on for a long, long time, and that was the best way they could explain them then. But for us here in the United States, yeah, I think that probably Barney and Betty Hill was one of the first big cases that got a lot of media attention.
It was how many years was it before that actually came to the attention of the media? Was it 3 or 4 years?
Life Magazine. Well, I think I can't remember the gentleman who wrote the book Interrupted Journey, but when Interrupted Journey came out, that really set the press on fire. And Life or Look Magazine, I think maybe 1967, did a big article on their abduction, including with the first time a bust. An artist's conception of what we've come to call a gray.
Yeah, that's... Now, do you know of any accounts, Grant, prior to their case in which the grays were referred to?
I haven't heard of any. I think if an individual was to do a search of the literature surrounding it and some folklore, they may be able to come up with something, that might be similar. I think that if it did happen, even now, folks are very reluctant to talk about if they are abducted. At least that's been in my personal experience with some of the folks that we've contacted through Paranexus. They're reluctant to talk about it. So I would guess that maybe, folks were even more reluctant to talk about it back in the medieval days for fear that they might be hustled into the center of town and, burned at the stake.
Well, that's
obviously...
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, getting close to 2010.
Right.
But seriously, though, I could see that people would be very reluctant because they would be, cohorting with Satan. Might be interpreted that way.
Well, plus the fact that Benny and Barney were interracial, had interracial marriage.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Which you'd think they would shy away from any kind of media attention.
Uh huh. So in the Betty and Barney Hill story, I mean, let's just talk about your thoughts on it, Grant, because it came to light, and then they underwent. Regression therapy with, who was it? Do you remember his name?
Dr. Simon.
Yeah, Dr. Simon.
Dr. Simon, who was a psychiatrist. He was a well-known psychiatrist. He had done work with traumatized soldiers during World War II and afterwards, and was quite renowned for his work. Had been very successful, and he taped Barney and Betty soon found out, or after they came to him, he started doing separate sessions with them and really realized how traumatized they were. I think Barney was more traumatized by the whole experience than Betty was.
What do you think?
I think that Barney felt that he had to protect Betty, and I think that it was a complete... it just rattled Barney's sense of reality, what he was seeing, because, for all practical purposes, and I, of course, never knew the man, but basically what I've read about him, he seemed to be like a very pragmatic guy who worked for the postal service and, was pretty well grounded. And I think it just shattered his whole sense of what was real, because He obviously didn't believe it. And as the whole, if you recall from the story, Doug and John, they were coming back from a trip in Montreal. And they had been driving for a number of hours, and they were getting close to home. I believe they're in the White Mountains of Vermont. And Betty kept seeing what she thought was a UFO. She saw a light in the sky, and she kept telling Barney, that's not an airplane. And Barney kept trying to dispute it and say, no, it's just an airplane. Your imagination's running wild with you. And it just seemed to keep getting larger and larger. And to the point where they actually, you know, realized that whatever it was awful close to them. And they ended up pulling off on the side of the road. Barney broke out a pair of binoculars, and when he looked through the binoculars, he was stunned to see that he was looking right through a window on the spacecraft. Mm-hmm. And was totally freaked out because he saw somebody in there.
All right, so... I just got an email from Travis Walton. He is going. He's ready and waiting. So we're going to
wonderful.
Try to get him on the line. So let's try that right now. And we're ringing, waiting. Here we go. We hear a ring.
Hello,
Travis.
Yes.
It's Doug Kelly with Paranexus. You are on the air. So nice to get a hold of you.
Well, I was here at 6, and it took a long time to send an email, but...
yeah, we were trying.
We're certainly glad to have you, Mr. Walton. It's a pleasure.
Yeah.
And along with me is Grant Rubendunst and also John Rossi, who is screening our calls. So, sorry we had to do it a little bit late, but at least we got you on, so... And I'll tell you what, we were looking forward to this for a long time, and so it's nice. Travis, I've you know read your story many times, obviously seen you on documentaries, and I was just telling Grant earlier that I think, you know, in addition to the Betty and Barney Hill story, I think your case is probably one of the most well-known. Is that how you see it?
Well, I don't know. I've certainly been getting it. Huge amount of email and stuff lately. I don't know why, but it's coming in from all over the world.
Wow. One of the things, if you would be so kind, for some of our listeners who may not be familiar with your story, can you give us a just run through it? I know you've probably done it a billion times, but if you wouldn't mind giving us a rundown on what exactly happened, and then we can go from there.
All right. It was November 5th, 1975. I was... you know, in the movie, they have changed a few things, so I'll just tell you how it was. But there were 7 of us working out in the woods. We just finished a hard day's work, and we loaded up our equipment, and we're headed home. And unlike in the movie, we hadn't been going very far before we saw the light through the trees. That's to say that, you know, nobody was... nodding off or drowsy. Everybody had just recently been doing hard physical work, so we were wide awake and noticed this light coming through the trees, and it was kind of, you know, at first it wasn't all that alarming because, you know, it was just little glimmers through the trees, but, you know, I thought, well, maybe that was some hunters camped up there, closer we got, the more it seemed like the light was coming from higher than where the ridge top would be. See, we were driving south up the ridge towards the Rum Road, and the peak of the ridge was to our right. But when we got up to where there was a break in the trees and we could see the source of this light, boom, there it was. It was just unmistakable.
Hey, Travis, can I have you just speak up a little bit more? It's the bad connection, sorry.
Okay.
Better.
Good. Yeah, I could see the object there outlined against the sky, it was unmistakable. It was very close, less than 100 feet away, and Alan Dallas in the back yelled out, "It's a spaceship or it's a flying saucer," right off the bat, because there was just, you know, this wasn't some ball of light way off in the sky. It was close enough. We knew what we were seeing. But my thinking right at that moment was, just on the spur of the moment, was that it would be gone and take off pretty quick. So I got out and headed towards it to get a closer look. And, you know, what I was doing was really alarming to the rest of the crew, and they started yelling at me to get away from there. But I just was, you know, kind of took the opportunity to show off for him a little bit.
So you showed off for him?
Yeah, it was kind of dumb, but you know, at that point.
Just keep speaking up. The people in the chat room are saying it's just a little hard to hear.
Okay.
There you go.
All right. Well.
So you're shown off, and they apparently took notice.
Well, yeah, but as I got closer, the sound it was making suddenly got louder, and it started to move, and it rose up, and that scared me worse than I was already scared, so I jumped for cover, and there was a log sticking up there, and I got down behind that. And they were screaming at me to get back in the truck, get away from there. But, you know, I didn't need to be told. I was trying to figure out how to make my escape. But I raised up to run back to the truck, and something hit me. It was like I raised up under a solid chunk of steel or something. It was like I just got hit and didn't see it coming.
From behind, right?
I just blacked out, and it was much more violent than way it was depicted in the movie. In the movie, it just kind of looked like this spotlight comes on and sort of lifts the actor up and tosses him back. But they said it was like a stick of dynamite went off under me.
And really?
The way my body went sailing through the air and tumbled and fell limp like a rag doll. They immediately were yelling to each other, it killed him, it got him, you know, he's dead. And so that was the reason they panicked so much. One of the guys that happened to be looking in the other direction said that it just lit up the entire forest brighter than daylight. And it was really, really powerful.
Did the others see what hit you?
Yeah, you know, in the police report, one of the guys described it as looking like a long blue flame. One of the crew members said it was like a long beam. And Dwayne Smith, he later became an electrician, and he said that, you know, the sound it made to him sounded like high voltage. I don't know what exactly he was referring to there, but, you know, basically, you know, it was a brilliant bluish beam bolt of energy, and they thought it killed me. So they took off and nearly wrecked the truck trying to escape. And, you know, they received a lot of criticism from different people. You know, they used to be, you know, we'd get interviewed, and the first thing people would say is, yeah, a bunch of heroes, no real heroes, huh? But so, you know, they were being criticized for having, you know, fled, but to me that's totally understandable, because they thought I was already dead, and it's not going to do them any good for them to risk their lives, you know, to try to rescue me at that point and maybe have the same thing happen to them. So, you know, I find no criticism, and I always try to emphasize that because of, you know, the criticism they've got, that you know, they did what they should have done. You know,
well, that makes sense, yeah. It makes sense. I mean,
yeah.
They thought you were dead, and they were afraid for their own lives.
So they went up, and they saw some hunters, and they tried to catch them, thinking they'd get somebody with guns to go back and with them, but they were unable to catch them, so they just decided to... You know, in the movie they have, when Mike says, look, this truck's going back, and we, you know, anybody who doesn't want to can wait here, you know, nobody volunteered to get out there and stand in the dark. You know, they all elected to stay in the truck. So they all returned to try to rescue me that night. And, you know, they deserve credit for that. So when they were approaching the area again, they thought they saw it leaving, and that helped a little. But it took quite a bit of courage for them. But when they got there, they said they located the spot, and everybody got out and stood shoulder to shoulder, all huddled around one flashlight that they had, made a search. They said they were calling and whatnot. One of the guys told me that, you know, the crew boss kind of had a little bit of a breakdown there and fell to his knees and was crying. But, you know, they got a grip on it and themselves and headed back to town and argued about what to do. And, you know, Alan Dallas, he'd had a little trouble with the law in the past, and he wasn't too keen on going to the authorities. But he thought we ought to just get some friends with some guns and come back. But the rest of the crew said, what if, you know, Travis is never found? You know, how's that going to look if we don't go to the authorities? So they went and called the sheriff. And the sheriff and his men interviewed the guys, and even though it took a while for them to get there, that the men were still so shaken looking, so traumatized, you know, the white faces, and some of them were still crying, and the shock was so evident that the police had no doubt something real serious had happened. So they didn't dismiss it as a joke, but they immediately developed a theory that there'd been some kind of a fight and maybe some kind of a chainsaw murder, and these guys had made up a wild story to cover up for why there was never going to be any Travis around anymore. Wow. So, unlike in the movie, they did go back that night. Some of them did with the lawman and made another search, but the main search began the next morning. The sheriff had all of his men out there and the posse members, which is a separate thing, and the Silver Creek Rescue search and rescue people. They had the Forest Service helping them and some civilian volunteers, and they had people on horseback and just traveling every road on four-wheel drives and just basically combed the entire area. The sheriff had everybody spaced out within sight of each other and just made these big sweeps through the forest. And, you know, they were also crisscrossing the area in helicopters and airplanes. And even the tracking dogs, they were unable to find out any trail past the clearing there. The trail went to the middle of the clearing and that was it. So, and the horses were behaving kind of strangely, they said. Anyway, during the search, one of the searchers grabbed the shirt front of one of the crew guys and jerked him up close and said, "All right, where'd you hide the body?"
Mm-hmm.
So they said, you know, all the guys, you know, joined in at that point and said, "We did not kill him, and we'll take any kind of test you want, sodium pentothal, lie detector, anything." So the sheriff took them up on it and called in the state police polygraph examiner and tested the men. And so when they passed, they had to move on to other theories to try to explain it away. But that, I guess, has never ended.
So anyway, how long did they search for you total, or are you getting to that?
I guess it was beyond four. It was kind of like in two parts. They did a search and then called it off and then reinstituted it. But it took most of 4 or 5 days, I guess. Well, the next thing I knew, after being knocked unconscious, I was regaining consciousness kind of slowly. And I was in a lot of pain, so I didn't just, like, come to real quickly. I was in and out for quite a while. I was having a lot of trouble breathing, and it was pretty painful. At first, I didn't even know where I was. I I didn't remember anything. And then I remembered approaching the object in the woods, and I thought maybe I'd just been hurt and they'd taken me to the hospital. So, you know, I was laying there thinking I was in the emergency room. They had this device across my chest, and everything hurt so bad, I figured I'd better hold still. So I didn't make things worse, but I could hear the sounds of movement around me, and I just took those to be medical personnel. I was lying on my back, and I could see a light above me. It was right up. I figured I must be laying on some kind of raised bed or table or something, because the ceiling was so close. But
so the ceiling wasn't very far above you then?
No, it was fairly close. So, my eyes were, you know, kind of blurring and having trouble focusing. But when I could finally clear my vision, that's when I could see that these people standing over me were not people at all. You know, I was looking square into the face of the creature, and that just flipped me out. I instantly just lost it, and I just kind of really just flipped out with fear. But, you know, a lot of people don't understand that. They think they would remain more calm and more in control, but you got to understand the circumstance. I felt weak to the point where I couldn't move hardly, and, you know, that's pretty scary.
Yeah.
The pain made it, you know, anything I was seeing seemed scary. But the main thing is that I couldn't catch my breath. You know, nothing will, you know, make you panic more than having your air cut off. And I think that must be why they waterboard people to get information out of them. It works. But, you know, there's a scene in the movie where the actor is held down on a table, and there's a membrane over his mouth, and he's struggling to breathe.
Right.
And although that didn't happen, I think it does a better job of communicating to the audience the panic you feel when you can't breathe. And so, you know, I helped that helps to understand why I lost it so much. But the other part of it was their eyes. These creatures, when they looked at me, it just had this really weird effect on me. It just seemed like they were looking right into me or something. And you know, their eyes were really one of the main things that was in the center of my nightmares for months after that.
Well, can you describe the eyes?
Well, they were these beings were small, you know, 3 or 4 feet tall, and not all that big and scary in the sense of being, you know, large. But as soon as I saw them, I tried to push them away from me, and I lashed out with my arm, and when I touched the one that was nearest, he seemed to be softer and lighter than I expected, and he fell back into the other one. And, you know, fear gave me the strength to roll off the table, and that thing they had on me fell off. And I sort of stumbled back away from them, and they came around the table towards me. And I just looked behind me, just grabbed for anything I could to fend them off or scare them off with. So I just grabbed the biggest thing there. There was a bunch of instruments laying out there, but I grabbed this one long, thin thing and lashed out at them. Before they were close enough to actually hit, and I was just mainly screaming and trying to look ferocious, but they stopped, and they sort of extended their hands just for an instant, and then they all turned at the same time and went out the door. And, you know, another thing that was adding to the panic was that I saw no escape. I had my back to the wall, and the only way out of this little room, I guess you could call it, was beyond them.
So it was a small room?
Yeah, it was pretty cramped, and it was very humid, and like I said, the claustrophobia feeling was probably added to that because of not being able to breathe, but... They went to the right, And so I went out the and down this passage to the left, and I panicked and hurried down the passage, but it was curving so tightly to the right that I couldn't see very far ahead of me, and I also couldn't see very far behind me to see if they were coming after me. But finally, I came to a room and ducked out of the passageway into there. But when I moved in there, it dimmed, and I could see points of light. It was darkest near the center of the room where this chair was, but I could see points of light all around. But my only thought was to open the door and get out of there.
Yeah.
And I wasn't thinking very clearly, but in the back of my mind, I was thinking that this thing was still in the woods. And, you know, all I had to do was open the door and drop to the ground, but that may have not been the case, so it's probably a good thing I wasn't able to figure out how to open some hatch or door or something. But, there was some rectangles, cracks on the wall that I thought might be doors. And I went to one that was directly opposite the door that I came in, and I couldn't see any doorknob or button or any way to open it. So I went over to the chair and fiddled with some of those controls, and most of them didn't seem to do anything at all. There was a little bit of movement on this screen, one control, this lever, made the star pattern move. The whole thing shifted. So that was rather disorienting because they were all, the star points or the points of light were all around me. But something caught my attention from the door that I'd come through, and I turned around, and there was a man standing there. And
human.
That's what I thought at first, and so I started towards him and saying all this questions about these creatures in here. How can you get me out of here? Where are you from? I thought I was rescued. Maybe something like the Air Force or something. NASA, I don't know. But he wasn't responding to my questions. But, just the fact that there was somebody there that looked human, that didn't seem to be terrified like I was pretty helpful. And so when he tried to, lead me out of there, I was only too happy to go. And he took me out through this little airlock thing. I assume that's what it was, but when we came out the other side, the air was a lot easier to breathe, and the light was much brighter. It's almost like out of doors. It was at this point, this craft was sitting on the surface inside of a large room or a large maybe part of, like a hangar or maybe a part of a larger craft.
Wow.
But I tried to look around. I could see that this room was shaped sort of like a quarter of a cylinder on its side. The roof curved into one wall, and there was these panels giving off light. I don't know whether it was artificial light that was a lot like sunlight, or maybe the panels were just translucent and it was sunlight. But it was quite a lot brighter than it was inside that craft. And I felt better. I felt like I could breathe easier, too. I tried to look around, but he seemed to be in a kind of a hurry to get me out of there. And I was still kind of stumbling. But he rushed me out and down this hallway. And he took me into a room where there were some other people dressed like him. The only difference was that these individuals did not have the helmet over their head.
So this, that was, he had the, a, go ahead.
Yeah, he had a helmet on his head, and that was the reason I kind of wasn't too alarmed by the fact that he wasn't answering any of my questions. I thought that maybe he couldn't hear me without on, or couldn't talk with it on or something, but they weren't wearing helmets, so I started in with the same, well, I guess it was babbling, you know, I was just yelling all kinds of things at them, but they didn't answer either, and so that was a little bit more alarming because, you know, I knew they could hear me, especially when they came up close and they were trying to put me down on this table and I was yelling, and I could see that when I was loudest, you know, they kind of winced. So I know they could hear me, but...
Can you describe what they looked like? I mean,
Well, they were just... They'd pass in a crowd on Earth, you know, light-colored hair, sort of Caucasian with a tan. I don't know.
Were they same average height as human beings and all?
Well, I think they were a little taller than me. They were, you know, I'm 6'1". But they were a lot stronger than me. Probably even if I hadn't been in such a weakened condition, they could have overpowered me, which they did. They tried to get me down on the table, and I was trying to fight back. And when they put the mask over my face, that really caused a burst of energy. And I was able to get one hand free, and I got it under the edge of the mask, but I was too late, and... I just blacked out. Boom, I was out cold. I don't know what was in that thing, but it worked fast. And next thing I knew, and I really don't know, I didn't know how long it'd been. I woke up, I was laying face down.
Speak up just a bit, if you would.
It was cold outside, and... I was lying on a hard surface. My head was across my arm. There was a light above me, and I looked to see where the light was coming from. And as soon as I looked, it went off. But then I saw this shiny hull hovering there for a second in the dark, and then it just shot up into the sky. And it was gone so fast, you'd think it would have just broken the sound barrier, but... It was silent. The air kind of swept a little bit in behind it, and the leaves moved and stuff, but not real bad. And I stood up. I was still pretty wobbly, but I looked down the hill, and I recognized the lights of Heber. That's the town nearest where this happened. So I ran down into the town, and knocked on a door where it looked like somebody might be up, and nobody answered. So I went on down across the second bridge, and I came to a row of telephone booths, and I went into the first telephone booth, and it was out of order. So that was kind of a letdown there, but I went into the next one, and it worked. You didn't have to have coins to talk to the operator, and I made a call to my brother-in-law, and he thought it was a prank call and started to hang up on me. But I screamed at him and got him, convinced him it was really me. Family had been receiving all kinds of calls, and some of them were kind of ominous, and some of them, you know, just annoying because it's people's idiotic concept of humor. But I still didn't know how long I'd been gone. And when they finally came and picked me up there, by the way, I was fully dressed, Hollywood notwithstanding.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. So you had the same clothes on, obviously.
Yeah. And I must have passed out right after the call because it seemed like just a couple of minutes and then the lights were shining in there. But
what time of the day was it?
This was the middle of the night. I don't know.
Oh,
it was
okay.
Probably after midnight. But the operator was well aware of what had been happening in the area and broke the law. And listened in on the phone call and notified the sheriff. So he sent him in to the phone booth, but I guess in the middle of the night he had trouble getting anybody there in time because my family came and got me, and when my brother saw the shape I was in, he said, "Man, I'm not letting that mob get a hold of him in the shape he's in." All the stuff that had been going on in town, for one thing, I thought it was still the same night. I thought this was Wednesday, but, he said, "Travis, you've been gone for 5 days." And, that just flipped me out. I just kind of like finished me off. I looked at my watch and the date had changed and said, "Feel your face." And, I had to grow the beard. And, man, I started really kind of backtracking my mind. And then
did you speak up? Keep speaking up. You had to back.
That took me back to where I'd just been.
Yeah.
And that was a disturbing place to go. But I'm sorry about the volume, but I've done a bunch of interviews on this same phone, and I haven't had this trouble before. Anyway,
that's okay. You're doing. You sound good now.
Anyway. The family had received some calls, and one of them had come from this nurse, and she said she had been working at a hospital where this elderly couple had been brought in, who had this encounter with this UFO, and they were in pretty bad shape. But when she came back on shift the next time, all their records were gone, and they were gone, the bosses were denying that they'd ever been there. So she just said, just be careful who you let get a hold of him if he ever shows up again. And then they got another call from this guy that said he was retired CIA. And he left his contact information, but he said the same warning, just be careful who gets a hold of him when he's returned. So my brother's first thought was to get me away from this crazy circus going on in town here with all the there was reporters from England and Japan, and, people, shooting pictures through the window and tromping through the flower bed, and, phone calls and stuff. It was just really hard on the family, plus all the accusation of murder and the search and everything that was going on. So my brother took me to Phoenix to get medical help. He'd been approached at the site during the search by a UFO investigator who told him that, if I was ever returned to contact him, that he had medical people in his organization that would ensure the that I was okay and, research what had happened. But turned out to be really a bunch of phonies. Everybody in the organization had phony credentials, and the so-called doctor wasn't a doctor. But it wasn't too long until after that we were contacted by the Aerophenomena Research Organization, who did have real doctors in their Phoenix membership, and they arranged a bunch of tests, and I had a whole battery of different medical examinations. EKG, EEG, blood tests, just a whole bunch of stuff, upper body x-rays. Even as far away as Phoenix was, coming out of the Barrows Neurological Institute where some of the tests were done, and people in the parking lot said, "There he is," and started chasing
him. Oh, my God.
It was a madhouse. It was crazy. And the shape I was in, that was pretty bad, especially since when we went there, the physician that referred us had put me in there under an assumed name to avoid that problem, but it was pretty bad, and they were trying to explain it the way they could, and the UFO group that had been that lost the case suddenly switched to making negative comments and claiming that it was all a drug hallucination. So the doctors ran my blood and urine samples through the county medical examiner's drug screen, which showed no trace of any drug in my body. And then they moved to the theory that I'd had a transitory psychosis. So I underwent a whole battery of psychiatric examinations that proved I was perfectly sound mind. But what the media failed to ask was, you know, how do seven people have the same delusion, you know?
Yeah.
It just doesn't happen. Anyway, so that was the story for a long period of time, you know, people trying to explain away, especially the debunkers. And they really don't care what sort of methods they use. They'll resort to falsehood if that's what they...
Yeah, that's the debunkers. Let me ask you a few questions. There's some questions in the chat room that I've been sitting on, and if you can answer a few of these, we'll get these out of the way. I hope I'm starting at the beginning here. Give me one second. The first one is back when you were in the small room and they were extending their hands. The question is, did you have any kind of feeling that they were trying to help you or that they were friendly?
Well, I didn't really understand the gesture. To me, you know, in my state of unclear thinking and total panic, their hands extending towards me was just something really hideous reaching out at me, you know. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, it could have been some sort of a gesture. It was a sort of a open palm sort of extension of their hand. So, you know, that's a question that hasn't come up before. But, yeah, it might have been a gesture rather than anything.
Another question is, did they find any marks on you?
Well, the examining physician said that he found a 2-millimeter red spot on the inside of my right arm, which really helped fuel the drug theory, but the doctor said it was not over any major blood vessel and said it was partially healed. So I think that it was most likely, you know, an injury that I had received at work prior to the incident.
Was the ship that you saw in the beginning, or I don't know if you even were able to see a ship from the lights in the beginning, but the ship that left, were you able to get a good look at it? Can you describe it, if so?
It was shaped like, it was a disc, kind of like two pie pans, but lip to lip with a dome on top, and kind of angular. But the one that returned me was more rounded and shinier. I don't know the significance of that, but...
were they roughly different. The same size, or was one bigger?
Those were roughly the same size, but the one I came out of seemed to be bigger than the one that picked me up in the woods.
How big would you say it is, or was?
Well, in the woods, I would have estimated it to be like 20 or 25 feet in diameter. But when I came out of it, it seemed like it would have been, I don't know, half again bigger than that. But, you know, I could be wrong. It could have been
sure.
My
okay.
perceptions. But.
And the last question that I think that we have in the chat room is, how are you doing now? Have you been able to resume a somewhat normal life?
Well, you know, when you get knocked off the bicycle, it's important to get back on, you know, in order to, you know, restore yourself. So, you know, I made myself go back to the woods eventually to work, but I tried to make sure it was only in the daytime, and I admit I took a gun with me, but I had to do it. And,
yeah.
After I'd done that a while, I went to work at the mill and didn't do woods work after that.
Were there any lights, or what color was the lights on the ship is another question.
Well, it was kind of strange. It was silvery, the metallic was, but the surface was glowing at the same time as reflecting light. So at the same time it was giving off this golden glow, you could see the trees around there reflected in at the same time, which is kind of funny. But I guess it's kind of like the glare you get off the TV. When the TV's on, you can see the picture, but you
sure.
can't see things.
Hey, Travis, this is Grant. You know, I've always been fascinated by your abduction experience. And my question to you would be, here it's been like, what, 30, almost 40 years since the event occurred. In retrospect, what do you think now is the most remarkable thing about the whole experience to you? What
well,
comes home?
There's... And so many things about it were just confounding. I mean, my life was never going to be the same again. You know, one of the most, you know, riveting things was those eyes that dominated my nightmares for a while.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, in retrospect, you know, I could comment on, you know, why in so many reports, including the movie, did they completely ignore the presence of these human-looking beings?
Yeah.
You know, it's like they just had tunnel vision, oh, there's some alien creatures, and that's all they wanted to think about. But to me, the presence of human-looking beings, you know, that could might be the key to the whole mystery, especially if there's some Earth-based connection.
Well, they're certainly not as sensational as aliens would be. The creatures that obviously, you know, first of all, you've been traumatized, and now you have to deal with these entities, whatever they may be. Did you get just another real quick question? Did you feel that they any feeling like they might have been mechanical as opposed to being flesh and blood creatures?
I get that question a lot, and you know, they did not look mechanical. But I've got to say that, you know, any really super high tech being that could actually function in place of a living being, I don't imagine you'd be able to tell. Especially if the intention was that you wouldn't be able to tell. It's not going to be jerking and whirring and you know, like you see in some of these silly TV robots. You know, anything that was, you know, like that, I think would be good enough. You couldn't tell. But, you know, when the little ones left that room, they moved kind of quick, and it was, you know...
And in unison, right?
Yeah. But they were small, but it was kind of like a scurrying sort of a motion. Like a, I guess that's consistent with them being light and weight like that, but it was a very natural, quick sort of movement.
Through the rest of the experience, did you ever encounter them again, or you just strictly were dealt with by the human looking crew members?
Well, the conscious period that I recalled under hypnosis and described to the researchers there, you know, I never saw the two types of beings together, so I don't really even know the nature of their interaction. Were one acting on behalf of the other? Was there a forceful intervention here? Was there
Or were
an ongoing
same?
Cooperation? I don't know.
Were they the same? Were the humans a mental projection?
Well, you know, that's one theory, that they might have been something presented to me just to reassure me that, you know, something more familiar. And vice versa, you know. Some people saying, well, it was really the human beings and they created these little creatures, or vice versa. But
well, here's a
I don't
question.
Know. All I know is what I saw. Go ahead.
Here's a question in relation to that from the chat room. The suits that they were wearing, did they, and I'm guessing this is referring to the Greys, did they resemble the Greys that Whitley Strieber describes?
No. I guess the main difference, I'm not real familiar with the other descriptions, but the main thing is the eyes were eyes. I saw them blink, you know, and they had an iris and a pupil and like that. Even though they were huge and had this horrible effect on me, they were eyes.
So they weren't the big black gray eyes, like you see.
Yeah. You know, I think that there's probably a little more variety than people might suspect.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's a big universe out there, so...
Yeah.
And not everybody has to look like a gray that may be coming around.
Yeah. And any beings that are kind of similar are going to get lumped in, but, you know, with thousands of planets, you know, why would they all look in two or three or four different basic types? I'd say that people are kind of rounding off here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the thing that's really interesting too, Travis, is I've seen the movie, and I saw you do a presentation when you're disputing some of the events in the movie. But one of the things I find really fascinating is when you talk about your difficulty being able to breathe. And I'm just wondering if maybe, you know, in that environment where you're in, you also described it as being humid. And then when you went out to the other area, I just wonder if maybe you weren't actually in an atmosphere where it wasn't all that conducive, you know, or the nature of the atmosphere wasn't the same as what we have here. And maybe you were struggling to breathe because the atmospheric conditions were totally different.
Yeah. I thought at first that maybe it was just due to my injury, that maybe being hit in the chest with that beam somehow interfered with lung function. But it did get easier to breathe when I came out of there. And, you know, I don't know, your chest might tighten up when you're in panic. And you know, my fear went down some at that time, too. But it could be right. And, you know, it would be consistent with the appearance of these things. Large eyes and a dimly lit interior would suggest a thick atmosphere that doesn't let a lot of light through. And, you know, maybe their small chests found it easier to extract whatever they needed out of the air with a smaller lung capacity. And
I think it's interesting that the humans that you saw, or the human types, weren't in that area, correct?
Yeah. And the one that was wearing a helmet, and there had to be a reason for that.
There you go.
I was afraid it might be something like infection or something, but it could easily just be atmosphere.
Were the little beings, were they scanning your thoughts? Did you get that impression?
They weren't getting much if they were scanning, because that was scrambled.
Yeah. So, we're getting real close on time here. We've got about a little over 3 minutes to go. So, all in all, I mean, obviously you've talked about some of the lessons you've learned from it, and that is to, you know, get back up on the bike or get back up and brush yourself off and so forth. You know, has there been any other meaning in it for you?
Well, I've learned a lot about the so-called experts, you know, and a lot about the naysayers. You know, I've taken and passed 6 different lie detectors by 3 different examiners. Over all in all, the crew and my family, you know, there's like 15 or 16 polygraphs passed in relation to this. And that would have been more than enough evidence to convict the person of murder and execute them under our system of law, but still, you know, some skepticism persists. And I said in the book, I quote Emerson, condemnation without investigation is the height of ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
Time and time
mm-hmm.
again, when I encounter skepticism, it's somebody who hasn't even bothered to look for the facts.
Well, please,
hey, Travis, if I could just one
no
question,
question.
Travis. What did you have any contact from any government agency to your, you know, after the, in all this time afterwards and the state?
Yeah, there were a number of contacts that made me, you know, and these things have kind of nagged at my mind over time about some covert government action, and there's a number of them that I detailed in the book. During the search, the investigators found some unusual magnetic readings. Well, I found out later that the following summer, a federal crew came in there and were making magnetic readings on the ground. Now, that could be a coincidence, but there's a lot of coincidences here, like the fact that there was a witness and turned out to be, said he was just there deer hunting, but he turned out to be from military intelligence.
Isn't that interesting? Had there been reports of UFOs in the area? I know you alluded to one, but, you know, in your research and when you were doing your book, did you find out whether or not there had been other sightings around the same time that you were abducted?
Oh, yeah. And along the time the movie came out, we were able to get the sheriff's file, and he'd taken affidavits from a number of people who had seen things in the area at that time. But I don't think this area is any kind of a hot spot. I think these things are seen everywhere, especially in remote areas. And so, you know, nothing out of the ordinary in that respect, but definitely other sightings, other people, and here and everywhere.
Hey, Travis, I extended the show just a few minutes. Do you have just a few more minutes to hang with us?
Absolutely. You've got to make up for getting a late start.
Terrific. That's so kind of you. We appreciate
it. Yeah, the people in the chat room are hooping and hollering and thinking us. So, all right. So that gives us just a few more. Some good questions, Grant, too. And this whole thing about the because you had mentioned that there was a nurse who had known about some records. Is that right? And they were no longer there.
There was another couple in another state, I guess. I don't know where she was calling from, but at the hospital she worked at, they brought this couple in, and she was treating them, and they were in pretty bad shape. But when she come back on shift the next day, the couple was gone, and their records were gone, and everybody was denying that they'd been there.
So there's some anecdotal evidence or some circumstantial evidence there to suggest that government knew something about this. Here's a question I have for you, Travis. You know, I'm not aware. Now, this doesn't mean it's not true, but I'm not aware of another case where somebody was gone 5 days. Have you heard of any others like that?
No, I haven't. And also that it was reported to authorities while the person was still missing.
Yeah. That's true. Of course, you know, we're talking about a smaller town, right? And people who knew you. And
yeah.
And there was a question earlier on that I had overlooked. Was the FBI in on this, or was it just local authorities?
I don't know what sort of interaction the sheriff's office might have had with other agencies, other than this one federal criminal investigator who came in and tried to intimidate the crew boss. He wrote up a confession and tried to, claim a bunch of stuff about his contracting, but it was all bogus, and he said, "I ain't signing that," and so the guy left mad because he was really a very intimidating person, and that seemed to be his goal. But we did find out that he had gone to the sheriff and obtained a copy of the file on the UFO incident. So that seemed to be a message to shut up or we'll make your life difficult.
Travis, what kind of contact, if any, do you have with the fellow crew members that experienced the event with you?
Well, the youngest guy on the crew, you know, when my very first book came out and he found out that I'd written in there about him crying, I mean, he got mad and came over to my house and wanted to fight, you know. But, you know, he was not the only one crying, and he certainly wasn't the only one scared. And so, you know, he was upset about that. But he was also pretty traumatized. His family said that he wouldn't even go outside at night for a long time after that. Uh-huh. But I'd lost track of him. He'd been a long-haul trucker for about 30 years, and here a couple of months ago, he called me up and he said that his young daughter was old enough to start asking questions about it. And so, you know, he wanted me to talk to her. And, you know, I was able to tell her that, you know, the fact that he did return to try to rescue me that night, you know, was pretty heroic, and that, you know, he'd been one of the bravest of the guys in one sense that, you know, like he kept looking and never took his eyes off of it, whereas some of the other guys were trying to crawl under the seat and ducking down behind the window and missing parts of it because they were so scared. So, you know, I thought that it was good that I was able to kind of mend fences with him after not hearing from him for so long. But I also found out here a while back that, much to my surprise, that one of the guys on the crew had been going back to the site of the incident by himself and camping out alone at night on the anniversary of the incident. And I was just flabbergasted. I don't know what. And I told him, you don't want something like this to happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
But that's exactly what he
wanted. Maybe he was trying to make some sense of it, you know, even after all these years, because, you know, what you guys experienced was it traumatized all of you. There's not a question about it. And, I mean, obviously, I mean, all the accounts I've read and, of course, coming from you. But when the police got there and they realized that you guys were so traumatized, they knew that something had happened. They knew that, you know, you guys were all hard working. You're out there, you were logging. You guys, you know, it doesn't take much to shake you guys up, you know. I mean, I've seen, you know, you guys are hardworking fellas. So, I mean, that must have made an impression on them, no doubt.
Yeah, and that was the reason they knew something terrible had happened, so they had to come up with something that they could get their minds around, and it was easier for them to think a murder had happened than to think that.
Here's a question from the chat room. Did you experience any psychic events or psychokinetic type events? Where things would move by themselves, or, you know, stuff would turn on or off, or that sort of thing, after the event?
In the aftermath? Mm-hmm. You know, if anything weird was to happen afterwards, if I was to recover memories or if I was to see something like that again, I doubt I'd go public with it, you know.
Uh-huh.
you know, I've been praised for having the courage to come forward and talk about this, but I don't deserve that because I you know, it was worldwide news by the time I was returned, and you know, I really didn't have any choice.
Yeah, but you're still talking about it, so that's a good thing.
Well, you know, I think it like it or not, it put a certain responsibility on me.
Wow, good attitude.
Yeah.
Here's another question. Have you experienced an overall world view change or paradigm shift per se?
Oh yeah, dramatic. You know, it definitely altered my one. For one thing, I don't take chances like I did before that. I was kind of a risk taker, and that, the whole thing of getting out of the truck and getting out there was pretty foolish. And I, you know, settled down a lot after that. I tried to think beyond the consequences. You know, that was just typical kind of stuff I do. There was wild horses in the area, and you know, so I got this bright idea. I'd bring this lasso of rope to work. You know, I was able to get pretty close to the babies, and I had this idea I'd lasso one and take them home with me. But you know, that was dumb. You know, if I'd have actually got that rope around that horse, those adults would have probably made mincemeat out of me.
Yeah, you know, I would imagine so.
So did you believe in UFOs before the event happened?
Yeah, I had a close relative who had had a sighting about 8 or 10 years before, so I was open to the idea, but, you know, it wasn't any all-consuming hobby or anything.
How much contact do you get now, Travis, from you know, the public? Do you still have a lot of people coming to you, asking you to recount the story, you know, other than folks like us on the radio?
Yeah, but, you know, probably the majority of them are people who have already heard the story and want to tell me theirs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I get, it's hard to stay up with the with all the email.
I can imagine.
Well, you know, there's other abductees out there. In fact, some are even listening to you right now tonight.
Have any of the folks that have contacted you over the years, Travis, characterized the situation that was similar to what you experienced?
Yeah, I get that. You know, and sometimes people will ask me, you know, should I come forward about this, or should I undergo hypnosis? You know, do I want to know or not? And I really have to answer these people that, you know, that's probably a very individual question. Everybody's going to have their own answer. They got to figure out how this would affect their own lives, their own situation that they're living in. Would knowing for sure be, you know, have a more quieting effect on their mind, or would that just open up a can of worms?
Mm-hmm.
Something that each person has got to answer for themselves.
Yeah, because it must be very difficult, and you know, you're obviously you've really looked at it from all sides, but it must be very difficult to have actually experienced something like that, know what you experienced, and have people, you know, like laugh in your face or tell you that you don't know what you're talking about, or you know, you saw an airplane, or whatever way they want to characterize it, when in reality you're the only person that really experienced it aside from the crew that you're working with, and that,
you know,
must be tough at times.
Yeah, it's really tough. But you know what's tougher than having anybody confront me about it, which they rarely have that kind of courage, is hearing about it behind my back. Or
uh-huh.
It's just like the emails. The emails that are critical are almost always like anonymous, got hidden addresses.
Yeah, we can relate to that. We get some of those here sometimes.
So, you know, I think a lot of those people are just afraid.
Yeah, they obviously don't understand.
That's really what's motivating them.
Yeah.
So what would you recommend to folks who feel that they've had an abduction experience in terms of making, I don't know, I'm not even sure how to put it, to make peace with it or to get on with your life or to, you know, to
well, I use the method that's really not commonly advised. I just use denial. You know, I kind of boxed this thing up and pushed it out of my life and tried to just get on with my life and think about other things. But it did give me a chance to take things out of that box a piece at a time and deal with them at my own pace. And, you know, it worked for me. But back then, there wasn't a lot of support groups or, you know, anybody that could deal with anything like this.
And how old were you at the
time?
The
first psychiatrists that were called in, you know, said that there's, you know, it's that there's no doubt that, you know, I've been through a traumatic experience and all this kind of stuff, but he didn't believe in UFOs. So,
so he would label it as some sort of psychotic break or something along those lines.
Yeah. He's definitely not lying.
Yeah.
But he's been through a traumatic experience, but that was as far as he'd go.
Mm-hmm. How supportive has your family been over the years, Travis?
Well, my family's been pretty supportive. And I think the best support has come from the people who know me best, my friends and relatives, because they know I'm not somebody that's going to make up something. And I certainly wasn't trying to get attention, that's for sure. I've always been a very private kind of person, and I've never brought the subject up on my own. You know?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, trying to raise kids in this environment, I tried to have a normal upbringing for them. I didn't ever, you know, let it dominate the topic in the household.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't a taboo subject, but it was just something that I didn't let intrude on their lives to the point where it would, you know, give an upbringing any different than it had been if it hadn't happened.
Now, do you still live in the same area, Travis?
Yeah, I still live in the same town. I'm the only one in the crew that still lives in the same town.
Do you get approached a lot by people on the street?
Well, you know, we're kind of out of the way here, and that's a good thing. I've been recognized in big cities, but sometimes I'll say, oh, yeah, I get that all the time. People are always telling me I look like
him. I look just like him. There you go. I like that.
Travis, tell people where they can get your books, your website, things like that.
Well, the book is only available through me. There are people, I saw one on eBay the other day for $295. This was a hard copy from way back that several of us signed. But right now there's a newly updated edition available, and it can only be gotten from me. And the website is travis-walton.com. And you just contact me directly there, and I'll send the ordering information to you.
Cool. I'm putting it in the chat room. Travis. Travis-walton.com, and the name of your book is?
Fire in the Sky, and it's 26 pages longer than the earlier edition, and it's got some new illustrations, so it's got quite a few illustrations now.
Travis, can I ask a question in regards to the movie? I know that you take exception to the movie, and my question is, the folks that did the movie, how closely did they work with you, or did they, you know, just touch base with you and then just, like, do their own thing?
Well, you know, when the script writer, you know, was the one who finally convinced me to do a movie. I'd turned down a number of offers, but he was convincing, you know, because he was well-versed in the topic, wanted to treat it seriously, didn't want to sensationalize it. And, you know, he kept his word to the ability that he could, because once, you know, the producers get involved and then the studio gets involved, you know, farther up the hierarchy you go, the more you lose power. So, you know, I lost all power. He lost quite a bit of his, but he did succeed in keeping them on track to a pretty good extent. They wanted to do some pretty wild stuff that he kept them from doing. So, you know, I don't blame Tracy Torme for what happened with the movie. As a matter of fact, overall, I think the movie had a positive effect. In spite of the fact that they changed things, people were opened up to taking a look at the facts, and that was my goal in agreeing to do it in the first place. So, but over the years, I never quit getting emails from people who say they read the book and they wished the heck that the real story had been told. So I'm kind of looking around to see if maybe somebody might want to remake it, you know, just to tell it how it really happened.
Well, it's you know, interesting. It's been, I mean, I've read it in various books and heard, you know, seen the story, seen you on documentaries. And so, you know, it's, I mean, in addition to Betty and Barney Hill, it's the most familiar abduction account I've ever read or heard of. And I remember seeing the movie, and I will tell you, when you talked about the plastic or rubber, whatever it was, being placed over the actor's face, in the movie, even though that didn't really happen, the effect you described was similar, correct?
Yeah, right.
And, you know, and that was very disturbing. I mean,
yeah.
Well, they kind of so, had you know, like in a zoo situation there, I thought, in the movie, where you were like encapsulated in like a huge gallery with other things, and you know, they kind of made it like they were zookeepers or you know, tagging wild animals or something.
Well, it definitely, you know, brought out the bug in the jar feeling that I felt, you know, laying on that table, you know. So, in many respects, the movie did, in a symbolic fashion, tell the story. You know, they simplified some things. I had two brothers, Don and Dwayne, who became Dan, and a lot of investigators and lawmen were rolled into James Garner's character, but I think some of the simplifications and the, you know, abbreviations were fair.
Well, that's great. Well, we really appreciate you coming and joining us tonight. It's an honor to have you and to hear your story. I was looking forward to hearing it from you. I wanted to, you know, kind of filter out all the other stuff and hear it. Well, the part about the humans in the ship, I had never heard. So I thought that was fascinating.
I think it's important for people to know because, you know, I'm beginning to suspect more and more some kind of Earth-based connection.
Well, and it almost makes you think that maybe they were the crew, or they could have been the crew, and they could have been, you know, the automatons or artificial life of some kind. And I think that, you know, that's probably one of the most interesting aspects of your abduction, plus the fact that nobody except you has been abducted for the same time frame ever, it seems. You know, I mean, people have their missing time, so maybe perhaps, you know, and I've heard of accounts of people going on and being abducted, and, you know, the time factor is all loused up where, you know, but who knows? Maybe you're in a different, maybe the ship has some distorts time somehow. But nonetheless.
Well, there's a lot of things about this case that were just kind of, I was just surprised that it didn't get more focus than it did. Like, for instance, the phenomenal growth of the trees right next to where the craft came down. There's a core sample, a picture of a core sample in the book that shows that at the time the craft came down, the tree rings had been uniform for decades and decades. And then at that point, they suddenly became very much thicker, to where calculations showed that the trees were producing 36 times the amount of wood fiber that they had in all those, you know, close to a century beforehand, and yet in 17 years the tree doubled in size. So that was pretty remarkable, and it wasn't until just a few years ago that finally some scientists got involved and took samples to the lab and stuff.
Do you know what they found?
Well, I don't understand all of the stuff. It was somebody who'd done some research on crop circles and the changes that some of those plants have had in their structure. And so I'm not a scientist, but, you know, it was pretty interesting stuff.
But, you know, Travis, I think you and I are probably of contemporaries in age-wise. And, you know, if you look back on it in 1973 and the attitude towards UFOs and abductions and the state of the science at the time, there's been some pretty big paradigm shifts since then and how we view our perspective as where we are in the universe.
You know, we've gone to Mars since then, you know.
The whole idea of us, you know, not then, it was like, there's no life out there. Come on, man. People are just like making this stuff up. Now, it's like we're getting closer, edging closer and closer to the fact, like, well, it's everywhere.
Yeah. Now they've identified hundreds of planets that are candidates to be Earth-like. Hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they found water on Mars and on the moon. And now they're looking at Titan as being a real good candidate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Doug and I have often said, you know, when I was a kid growing up in the 50s, nobody would have ever thought that there might possibly be life on Europa or, you know, Callista or one of those other moons of Jupiter or Saturn. You know, that would be the farthest thing, because we would have thought, well, Mars or Venus, couldn't be any of the other ones. We weren't thinking out of the box. I think now we're thinking out of the box a little bit more.
Yeah, and part of what stimulated that was discovering these weird life forms down under the ocean,
mm-hmm.
way down there where no light reaches, and they're living off of volcanic vents and completely, you know, almost alien life right here on Earth. So,
well, I think it's part of a growing-up process for humans, too, don't you think, Travis? Because I think we think of ourselves as being the center of the universe. And
oh,
I think over the past 40 years, we've kind of evolved, and maybe science, I mean, maybe TV and all of our science fiction, you know, shows have kind of made it more palatable for people that they kind of think like, yeah, maybe that could happen, as opposed to, you know, back in those days, I mean, you know, it was like, you know, there wasn't much going on science fiction wise in terms of where we are at now. So maybe we've been desensitized somewhat. Back then, there were little green men.
Yeah, but I think overall we still got a ways to go, though, people.
Yeah,
you know.
Absolutely, no doubt about it. We still have some big paradigm shifts that we've got to go through.
Now you can back a scientist in the corner and say, well, okay, probably life's out there, but I know for sure they can't get here. Well, you do.
Yeah, that's right. That's
look how far we've come in 100 years, and they might be thousands and thousands of years, maybe 100,000 years ahead of us. That stuff's going to look like magic.
Yep.
Absolutely.
So what message, Travis, before we close out the show, what message do you want to get out to the world? I mean, do you have anything burning inside that you want to make sure stays with people?
Well, I would like to improve the standards by which these things are investigated. You know, I thought about writing up a pamphlet, you know, maybe not sell it, just give it away, you know, things about how a layperson might, you know, evaluate a case, you know, is this good or not, because there are some good ones and there's some nonsense out there. Same thing with the investigators. I think that if they had some guidelines, it might improve the field. But I think, you know, in the long run, one day it's not going to be like these are monsters or some kind of semi-supernatural thing. It's going to be like those really strange people who live way over there that we don't know too much about, you know.
Mm-hmm. Good thinking. Well, we really appreciate you taking your time this evening to join us.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure speaking with you, Travis. Doug and I have both read your accounts, and, you know, we were just delighted to have you appear as a guest on the show. And if some point in the future you'd like to come back, we'd love to have you.
Yeah, great. My best to you guys and your audience.
Very good. And audience, be sure and visit Travis's website, travis-walton.com, and get his book. And Travis, please visit us at paranexus.org. And if you do write that pamphlet, be sure and let us know, and we'll help you distribute it. And you have a great night, and we'll hope to talk to you again in the near future.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you, Travis. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And we appreciate everybody's listening in on the show tonight. We were a little concerned there that perhaps we weren't going to have it, but, hey, it worked out, and we're happy to happy that it was. So, listeners, we appreciate you hanging with us. Please visit Paranexus.org. If you haven't already, we'd love to have you as a member. Paranexus is an association of anomalous researchers. If you're looking for some education in the field, visit ParanexusAcademy.org, where you can take courses there. And, of course, there's some free courses for members, so join Paranexus. Next week on our show, let me see who's coming up next week. We have
Lady Gaga.
No,
oh, darn it.
No, we welcome Paranexus consultant David Roundtree back. He's going to be talking about technology used in paranormal research, your questions answered. And I happen to know that David and Dr. Ingrid Irwin, also board member, and a couple of other folks, a couple of other members of Paranexus have been doing some research in EVP. So perhaps David will talk about that and comment on what they found, some interesting stuff. So we'll look forward to talking with David Roundtree next week. We invite you back. And with that, our time is pretty much gone. So we appreciate you listening. Join us Monday night at 10 p.m. Eastern for Informal Paranormal, where we'll take your comments as well. Grant, you have a great week.
Well, it was a great show, Doug, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And many thanks to our audience for their great questions and the folks in the chat room. It's always a delight. So everybody have a great weekend coming up.
All right. Take care, everybody. Good night.
Good night.